Is the universe finite or infinite? Why are sunsets beautiful displays of color? My guest, James Treffel, writes about the complexities of the visible world and the mysteries of the cosmos. He's a physicist who's able to interpret the latest scientific theories and science history for people who aren't science experts. Treffel has done science commentators for NPR's Morning Edition, and he's the Clarence J. Robinson Professor of Physics at George Mason University. His book, The Dark Side of the Universe, has just been published in paperback. His new book, Reading the Mind of God, is an explanation of the principle of universality.
The principle of universality is, it's one of those ideas that's so simple that you never even think about it. But what the idea is that the laws of nature that we discover by looking in laboratories on Earth right now apply everywhere in the universe, out to billions of light years away, and apply at all times in the past. The reason I say this is surprising is that if you look at the Earth the way an astronomer looks at it, as one little pebble going around one very undistinguished sun in a very normal galaxy, one among billions of galaxies, the idea that at this one place we could discover how this whole machine works is really astounding.
Well, I think I approve one of your theory being that it's taken for granted by scientists, this principle of universality.
Exactly.
But it comes as a real shock to a lot of lay people, and I think I fit in that latter category.
Well, exactly. The reason I wrote this book, Reading the Mind of God, is because I discovered that. I would give a talk to a lay audience, and I'd just throw this out in passing, and there'd be this sense of shock that, well, what do you mean by that? And I quickly learned that although scientists know about this and take it for granted, lay people don't. And that got me interested as to, well, how do scientists know this and how did we discover this rather astonishing fact? And that's really sort of my journey of discovery that I chronicle in this book.
Now, what rules, what kind of laws of science that apply on Earth are we talking about that also apply in the rest of the cosmos?
Well, the universe is run by a very small number of natural laws. That's one of the great insights of modern science, that maybe a dozen or 15 laws, conservation of energy, Newton's laws of motion, things like that, describe everything. And the science of physics, in fact, is devoted to taking all the millions and millions of things that we see and reducing their essence down to this small number of natural laws. And what we find is that if we look at what happens on Earth and we look at what happens in a quasar 15 billion light years away, the laws are the same.
How do we know this since we can't go that far and test it out?
Yeah, we can't actually get a piece of that quasar and bring it to our lab, but we can get something that's almost as good, which is we can get light and radio waves and X-rays and other kinds of things that come from the quasar to us. Now, if you think about it for a minute, when you say, you know, we have something in our laboratory, what does that mean? Well, if you remember your college chemistry, you know, very often you would take a chemical and you'd put it in a fire and see what color it was. You know, if it was blue, it was copper. You might remember some of that kind of thing. Well, what you're doing there is the light is going from the copper to you. The only difference between that little sample of copper you're holding in your hand and a quasar is that the copper is a few feet away and the quasar is billions of light years away. But from the point of view of physics, it doesn't make any difference. You're getting the same information from each.
Now, you trace our knowledge of the principle of universality back to Newton.
Mm-hmm.
How did he come upon it?
Well, of course, there's the famous story of the apple. He lived in a world where people had what we would now say, I don't like to use the word primitive, but let me just use that, I can't think of a better word, primitive ideas about how the solar system worked. And they believed that whatever it was that kept the planets moving around the sun was very different from the things that made things fall on the Earth. And according to Newton, he was walking in an orchard one day, and he saw an apple fall. And at the same time, he saw behind the apple, he saw the moon in the sky. And it suddenly struck him that the force that was pulling on the apple probably was pulling on the moon as well. And it led him to think that maybe there weren't two different kinds of forces in the universe, but only one kind, what we now call the force of gravity. And it made the apple fall, and it kept the moon in the orbit, and it kept the Earth going around the sun, and so forth. So this was the first step to realize that the Earth is not special, that the Earth is very typical of the rest of the universe. And it was the first step on this road to universality.
And before this, scientists thought that the heavens were ruled by separate principles from the
Absolutely,
Earth.
Absolutely, yes. If you go back to what was probably the most successful scientific theory of all time, which was the old Greek solar system of planets moving on celestial crystal spheres, it was felt that since the planets were moving in circles, that was natural. They didn't have to, you didn't need a force. It was perfect. That was the way the world was out there. But, of course, very different from what we have down here, because on Earth things don't move that way.
My guest is physicist James Treffel, and his new book is called Reading the Mind of God in Search of the Principle of Universality. Now, heaven is both a religious concept and a religious location,
mm-hmm. yes.
as well as the word that we use to describe the universe beyond us. The title of your new book is Reading the Mind of God. Mm-hmm. How does that concept of the mind of God apply to this theory of universality?
Well, we live in an age when science is seen as being very rational and essentially agnostic, if not atheistic. And one of the great shocks that you have when you start reading the history of science is how many of the important scientists were deeply religious men. For example, Newton and William Herschel, the first man who mapped the stars in the sky, really believed that what they were doing was discovering what was in the mind of God at the creation. You know, they were finding out how the universe worked, and to them that was a religious act. This is not the way we do science today, but it's the way they did it then.
So by discovering the physical laws, scientists believed that they were also discovering what was in the mind of God.
Yeah, what was basically a religious truth. It was discovering an aspect of God.
How do you see a religion and science tying together now?
Well, there's been a long history of antagonism between the two. I think rather needless antagonism. There are many scientists who are religious. There are many scientists who are not. And the usual, my own view, is that the two need not be connected. That is, science deals with a very specific set of, very specific subject matter. It deals with the physical operation of the universe. And whether that has to do with the existence of a God or any kind of religious belief is immaterial. It just doesn't, you know, they don't need to connect. I think there are problems. There are sort of imperial scientists who want to say, well, there's a material world and nothing else. And then there are religious imperialists who want to impose their views on the way the physical world operates. And neither one of them have had much success.
I want to get back to the principle of universality. If mm-hmm. we didn't accept that the laws of science on Earth also apply throughout the universe, would we be able to deduce anything about the universe?
Of course not, because, I mean, if you look at a distant star or a distant galaxy and see something, you wouldn't know how to interpret it. The fact that we look at distant galaxies and see that the light is slightly different from what you would get if you were standing there on that galaxy, is what we use to deduce the fact that the universe is expanding. If you didn't know what the light was supposed to look like when it came from that galaxy, i.e. if you didn't know what atoms there behaved like, you couldn't understand the structure of the universe. You would be lost. You could find out about Earth, and maybe the solar system now that we've sent probes out past Neptune, but that would be it. You could only say that your knowledge extended as far as you had gone physically.
Your previous book has just come out in paperback. It's called The Dark Side of the Universe, A Scientist Explores the Mysteries of the Cosmos. One of the mysteries you explore in that book is that the universe is constantly expanding. This is a greatly confusing concept to me, since we think of the universe as being infinitely large. How can infinity expand?
There are problems in conceptualizing this. The easiest way I know to think about it is one way to think about something like this, something that doesn't have an edge, doesn't have an ending, but yet is bounded, is to think about walking around the inside of a basketball. You know, you start at one place, you walk around, and pretty soon you come back to where you began, but you never got to the end. And many people who think about the universe think of it in terms somewhat like that.
Yeah, but a basketball isn't infinitely sized.
No, but what you mean by being infinite, it has no edge. There's no place you can come to the end and say, okay, it stops here and something else starts, you see.
Mm-hmm. But it has that rim, you know.
I understand. Yes.
And I think of it as this, like,
yeah,
you know, endless. There's no roof. There's no top. There's no bottom.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's several ways you can sort of fudge about that. Since the universe is only about 15 billion years old, the known universe, that is, the universe we know about, is 15 billion light years in radius. I mean, that we know. What's beyond that is, in a sense, not really something we can talk about, because it's not something we can ever see. But the other problem is that in dealing with this, it's hard to say, you cannot visualize in more than three dimensions. The human brain just wasn't built that way. And to understand this kind of expansion, you have to think in four dimensions. And the best you can do is make analogies. But every analogy has its limits.
Mm-hmm.
And you just pointed out the limit of my analogy.
I really have no concept at all of what a fourth, outside of like a few old Rod Serling shows,
yeah.
of what a fourth dimension might be and why we need to think in terms of a fourth dimension to really conceive of the universe.
Okay, well, you know, what you're asking me is actually, if I had to make a list of my 10 least favorite questions, this would be right at the top. What you're asking me in a different way is, if the universe is expanding, what's it expanding into? And the reason that it's not a favorite question of mine is because I haven't thought of a good way to answer it. Let me explain to you why. When I talk to or try to explain in English about scientific concepts, what I'm really doing is the same thing that a translator does when he or she translates a work of poetry from one language to another. I take the question you ask, and I translate it into the language of science, which is mathematics. Mm-hmm. And I look for the answer in that language, and then I translate the answer back into our language, which is English. Now, the problem is when you ask me this question, and I try to translate it into mathematics, I find that there's no translation, that the question can't be asked. It's a little like my asking you, well, what's north of the North Pole? And if you think about that for a minute, there's nothing north of the North. At the North Pole, you walk toward the North Pole, suddenly you're walking south again. You can go above the North Pole, but that's not north of the North Pole. You see, it's not that there's nothing north of the North Pole. It's that there's not even nothing north of the North Pole. And so I can't answer the question, and I give up.
So really, like, the word the fourth dimension is just a kind of stand-in for something that's totally out of reach, perception.
Well, no, the fourth dimension is supposed to be time. But what you want is a way of picturing that as a fourth dimension, and I can't give you one.
Right. Okay. Mm. When scientists say that the universe is constantly expanding, do they mean our knowledge of it is constantly expanding,
no,
or it is physically expanding?
It's physically expanding. The distance between us and neighboring galaxies is increasing. And the analogy that I like to use here is think about bread dough that's rising, you know, when it's sitting in your kitchen. If you have raisins inside the bread dough, the raisins are getting farther and farther apart. You know, and if you think of each raisin as a galaxy, that's what the universe is like. The galaxies are getting farther and farther apart. The whole thing is expanding. Where this analogy breaks down is that we're talking about being outside the bread dough, watching it expand, and it has an edge. Okay? The real case is we're inside the bread dough, and it's expanding, and that's a little bit different.
Do we know why it's expanding? Shall I say,
well,
do you know why it's expanding? Because I sure don't.
No one knows in the sense of giving a specific reason. The theories that we have, the explanations that we have to do with the way the universe originated. It originated in a very hot, very dense state, and hot, dense things tend to expand. And it's just like letting steam out of a kettle. The steam expands. And so the kind of expansion that we're seeing now is sort of a leftover of that early expansion, that early hotness.
Is it currently believed now that the universe will eventually kind of burn itself out?
Well, the best idea now is that it will keep on expanding, getting more and more tenuous, the stars will burn out, and it'll just sort of coast to a stop after an infinite time has passed. In other words, it's not, as some science fiction writers have suggested in the past, a case where the expansion will reverse, everything will fall back in on itself. Instead of a big bang, we'll have a big crunch, and then the whole thing starts again. Our best theory now is that probably that won't happen.
Your recent book, The Dark Side of the Universe, this is the one that just came out in paperback, mm-hmm. spends a lot of time describing dark matter and how our knowledge of that has been adding to the knowledge that scientists have about the universe. Can you give us a kind of basic explanation of what that is?
Yeah, it turns out, and this is one perhaps the most shocking discovery of the last 10 years in cosmology, is that at least 90% and maybe as much as 99% of the universe is in a form that we don't know and is not visible. I mean, we look out, we see galaxies, we see stars, we think, aha, that's the universe. It's all that visible stuff. It's stuff that's like us, you know, made out of the same stuff that we are. But by looking carefully at galaxies, watching how they rotate, watching how they interact with each other, you can tell that there's more stuff there than you can see. You can tell because it exerts a gravitational force on the stuff you can see. And the Milky Way, for example, our own galaxy, is at least 90% made of this other stuff, whatever it is. Now, the problem is that, I mean, this other stuff is there, we know it's there, but we have no idea what it is. The one thing that seems pretty certain is it's not stuff like us. It's not made out of the same kind of material that we are. It's something very different, something we haven't seen in our laboratories. So we're in a situation where we've spent centuries, you know, gaining this very tenuous knowledge of the universe, only to discover that what we've explored is one little corner of this tremendous unknown expanse that's waiting out there for us right now.
I'm a little confused. The dark matter is, it's a concept that's new in science. It's going to explain a lot about what kind of organizes the universe,
mm-hmm.
but we can't see it. We don't know what it is. Can you explain a little bit more about what it is?
Well,
what we think it might be?
Yes. Basically, if you think of the galaxies and the things that we do see, you think of the spiral galaxies you see in pictures as being embedded in some kind of a matrix. That matrix is the dark matter. We think that the dark matter is organized in ways that explain how galaxies are organized. In other words, it's like looking at an ocean. You see a set of islands in the ocean. You know there's a sort of an undersea mountain chain there. The dark matter is like the undersea mountain chain. The galaxies we see are like the islands. The reason I stress the mystery of the dark matter is because, as it's a new discovery, we really don't know much about it. We know what it does or what it's supposed to do. We know that it's there, but we don't know its identity. And until we know that, we really are ignorant of the major component of the universe.
Mm-hmm. And we don't have the tools to explore what's beyond our perception.
Well, I think it's not that we can't do it. It's just that it's such a new idea that nobody really knows quite what to do with it. And people are starting to gear up to learn more about it, to try to see if we can't reproduce it in the laboratories, whatever this stuff is. And by studying in detail the way it behaves, to try to get some sense of what, you know, just what it is really, there are lots of far out ideas, but no very very few firm ideas.
In one of your books, you quote a poet named Steve Weinberg, who once said, "The more the universe seems comprehensible, the more it also seems pointless." Mm-hmm. I was wondering if you shared his perception.
Not really. He's a Nobel laureate physicist, but he. I think he wrote that in a moment of gloom, contemplating this, what I talked about before, the universe expanding and eventually just disappearing. But, I mean, the fact that a quadrillion years from now the universe is going to be very different from what it is now and perhaps not hospitable to living things really doesn't make much difference as to how we're going to live our lives, you know, while we have them here. And so I don't see that it has much effect.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it doesn't make me gloomy.
Mm-hmm. Now, I understand, and I don't know exactly what this means, but I understand that the world's largest particle accelerator recently opened in Europe. What's in it for me, if you know what I mean?
Whether it's not the world's largest, it's a major installation in Europe. The world's largest is just outside of Chicago at the moment, and it will be, assuming plans go ahead, it will be in Texas, in this new superconducting super collider in Texas during the next decade. What's in it for you? Well, there are two kinds of things that are in it for you, depending on, you know, what you want. There's intellectual satisfaction, you know, just being part of this, the generation that solves the ultimate mystery of the physical nature of the universe. We're very close to that. But I would say, let me be more crass, and this is not for you, but what's in it for, you know, John Q. Public? There is a long history of basic research paying off. I mean, paying off in dollars. I mean, just to give you some examples, the Apollo program, which everybody dumped on during the 60s, the estimates are that for every dollar that was spent on the Apollo program, $7 in economic activity was generated in the economy in the next decade. So this was an example of basic research paying off. We live in an age when technological leadership is extremely important because the cutting edge, I mean, the American economy is going to depend more and more on our maintaining some kind of technological leadership. So, in essence, what you're doing when you build a particle accelerator is you're making sure that your grandchildren will have the kind of scientific tools that we inherited from our grandparents and will be able to move ahead as in fields of technology.
How did you get into writing books about science for non-scientists, trying to explain these incredibly complicated concepts and theories to people like me who don't follow science closely but, you know, are curious about it?
What actually happened is I gave a public lecture in about quarks. This is back in the early 70s, and quarks, you know, are supposed to be the fundamental constituents of matter. And one of my students, who's now a big shot at Lockheed, but was a graduate student at that time, came up to me afterwards and said, you know, you really ought to publish that because there are a lot of people who would like to read that. And I sent it off to Smithsonian Magazine, and they published it. And after that, I realized that there really was an important mission here that, I could do.
Well, I think science continues to become more and more incomprehensible to people who aren't experts.
Well, that's true, and it's becoming more incomprehensible even to professional physicists. And I find that, you know, at professional meetings, people will sidle up to me and say, "Hey, listen, I really enjoyed your book, and I learned all about cosmology by reading these things." And these are professional astronomers or physicists who are telling me this. So you're not the only one who needs it.
Well, James Treffel, I want to thank you very much for talking with us. Thank you.
My pleasure.